It was 11 in the morning on September 28, 2016, just 6 weeks before Election Day. Secretary of State John Kerry took the stage at the Woodrow Wilson Center right here in Washington, D.C., to give a speech on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. There was, and still is, an important debate taking place across the United States about trade policy. Under President Barack Obama, the United States has pushed forward with global trade liberalization. Secretary Kerry is a strong proponent of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, as it's more commonly known. It's a trade agreement that involves the United States, Japan, and 10 other Asia-Pacific nations. 7 long years in the making, TPP aims to promote growth, create jobs, raise living standards, reduce poverty, and enhance labor and environmental laws. But TPP has its critics. They argue that it will encourage businesses to move jobs overseas and allow corporate interests to run roughshod over countries' domestic laws. One of TPP's most vocal critics is Donald Trump. On the campaign trail, he called it a terrible deal that would cost Americans their jobs. Secretary Kerry directed his remarks at the Woodrow Wilson Center at members of Congress. He urged them to support the deal.
Make no mistake, if we retreat from this agreement, every government in the region, every business, every labor union, every group of environmental advocates, and the commanders of every army and navy will notice. And they will notice it in a way that does not work for the United States of America. It will be a unilateral ceding of American political influence and power with grave consequences for the long term. This is a critical agreement in every way.
6 weeks later, Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. He promises to throw out the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Like us, you probably paid close attention to the 2016 presidential race as it unfolded over the past year. With a victor now decided, you might be wondering, what next? Inauguration Day is just 2 months away. What are President-elect Trump's next steps? I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
And you're listening to The President's Inbox, a new Council on Foreign Relations podcast that examines the challenges President-elect Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20, 2017. On this show, we talk about the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about trade policy. There are numerous trade priorities that Donald Trump will have to balance, and TPP is only one of them.
I'm going to renegotiate NAFTA, one of the worst trade deals ever signed in the history of our country, perhaps the worst ever signed in the history, frankly, of the world. We're going to stand up to China, withdraw from TPP, which is another disaster, and protect every last American job. We are going to protect every last American job, which we're not doing now.
That's President-elect Trump at a rally in Wisconsin back in August. You heard him say NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement. That agreement involves the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Along with TPP and other issues, Donald Trump's trade inbox will not have its shortage of challenges.
With us to help examine these challenges is Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow specializing in U.S. economic competitiveness at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he directs CFR's Renewing America publication series, and as well as a blog. He's also the author of the new book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And this book presents an analysis of the last 4 decades of U.S. economic and trade policies and what went wrong along the way. Ted, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Bob and Jim. Thank you.
Ted, across the board here, how would you examine what's evolved now in U.S. policy on trade and where we might be going?
Well, I think very clearly we are at the end of an era. So ever since the Second World War, indeed since a little bit before the Second World War, the United States government has pursued trade liberalization around the world. It's tried to get other countries to agree to lower their trade barriers. The United States has lowered its trade barriers. This was seen as something that was good for the United States, good for the rest of the world. It would promote global growth. It would advance our security interests. Donald Trump made it very clear during the election campaign that he has a different approach. He wants to reassert what could be called economic nationalism. He sees trade as very much a zero-sum game in which there are winners and losers, and he wants to make sure that the United States is a winner going forward. That is a very different approach.
And he thinks that the United States has been a loser to this point.
He thinks the United States has been a big loser. He looks at the trade deficits in the hundreds of billions of dollars that the United States has been running for decades. He said that's proof that other countries are cheating. It's costing Americans jobs. It's costing Americans income. And he plans to change that situation.
Is he wrong?
I think he's wrong in a lot of ways. But what matters going forward is not so much whether he's right or wrong, but how these policies get carried out. I think it's clear there's going to be a change of direction. The question is, how sharp is that change? How much of a break is it from past approaches? And what sort of impact does it have? Not just on Americans and their jobs and the products they buy, but on the rest of the world as well.
Well, when you say zero sum, I mean, obviously TPP, there's a whole bunch of aspirations involved there, and a lot of very smart people have pointed to what the U.S. would benefit from, just the U.S. alone would benefit from in lowering tariffs and so forth. But NAFTA, we've got 20 years to look at, 20 years of a track record, and there are sums that can be examined there and sums on the positive register. Can you talk a little bit about if he's confronted with what NAFTA has really produced, both in terms of numbers and in terms of, say, binding the continent together, you know, what that might – how you might present that?
Well, I think, you know, clearly there have been a lot of positive outcomes from NAFTA. I think it bound the U.S. and Mexico much more closely together. I think it helped stabilize Mexico politically. We've seen the growth of continental supply chains in the auto industry in particular, which I think really has helped with the resurgence of the American auto industry in recent years. It's become a much more formidable competitor against Japanese automakers and Korean automakers. So I think there have been a lot of positives, but we also have, and Donald Trump hit on this in the campaign, seen factories pick up from the United States, move to Mexico. You know, this is not brand new, right? Factories used to move from New England to the southern parts of the United States, and a lot of them have kept going and gone to Mexico. This is something that Trump was very angry about during the campaign, and he said he wants to see a renegotiation of NAFTA that in some way puts a stop to this. How he's going to do that remains to be seen.
Can we just talk a little bit about job loss in trade? Because the impetus for Mr. Trump's comments is that he's worried about the loss of jobs in the United States, particularly manufacturing jobs. He has blamed trade deals for the loss of these jobs, for the fact that Akron, Ohio isn't the manufacturing powerhouse it once was, that textile firms in North Carolina have shut down, and you can multiply the examples across the country. But to what extent is trade really behind these job losses as opposed to improvements in technology? And take a classic example, automobiles. It takes many fewer people to produce an automobile today than it did in the 1950s or the 1960s. And you can replicate that across industries, steel industry, textiles. And we're going to see more of it with the advance of robotics.
Yeah, I think, you know, with the possible exception of the mid-2000s, and we can talk about the impact of China, I think the big story for decades has been a productivity story. So, you know, it used to be that 25% of Americans worked in manufacturing. Today, it's between 8 and 9%. We produce more, the United States produces more, manufactures more today than it ever has. So we're producing a lot more stuff with a lot fewer workers. There are changes in consumer markets too. You know, as people get richer, they buy fewer television sets and they go on more vacations or they get massages or they join health clubs. So the nature of our economy has changed. So the demand for manufactured
and
goods
also
has,
as people get older,
dropped as well.
As people get older,
healthcare and other services. So these are big changes in the economy over many decades. Those are the major things that have driven the decline in manufacturing jobs. As I said, I do think there's a bit of an exception in the 2000s. China's membership in the WTO and the huge surge in exports we saw from China, not just to the United States, but to Europe and elsewhere in the 2000s. I think economists are in agreement now that maybe 1 million, 2 million jobs were lost fairly directly as a result of Chinese import competition. And a lot of that was concentrated in those Rust Belt states that went for Donald Trump in the election.
But we should be clear here that was China's entering the WTO, the World Trade Organization. It was not the result of the United States signing NAFTA or negotiating TPP.
Coincided with the signing of NAFTA to some extent.
But it's not the case the United States has directly negotiated a trade agreement with China.
Yeah, and you know, do we want to call the WTO a trade agreement? I mean, the WTO are the rules that govern trade for basically every nation in the world. And in 2001, China was brought into the WTO. So we do not have a special trade agreement with China the way we do with Canada and Mexico under NAFTA.
Can we also talk about one other thing here, just to be clear, because we have been talking about trade, and when people think about trade, they think about tariffs. but actually for much of the United States trade relations, tariffs have been driven down on most products pretty low or eliminated entirely. And the amount of tariff reduction under, let's say, TPP is actually quite small because there are very few tariffs left to eliminate. A lot of the trade deals go well beyond tariffs to other sorts of issues, health and safety regulations, trying to harmonize regulations or what have you. And so the deals themselves may not have much of an impact on either jobs increasing or going down. Certainly that's what I've seen about sort of the preliminary assessments of TPP. For those economists who don't like TPP, job loss is actually kind of small given the scope of the U.S. economy.
And I would just add to that, you know, TPP, it wasn't just the Trump campaign. It aroused wrath. It aroused very strong feelings in both major campaigns, certainly the Bernie Sanders sort of Democrat insurgency campaign, and then some would say baked into the Clinton campaign as well. It's there is such invective directed at this deal. Could you talk a little bit, Ted, about what people are either seizing on or maybe exaggerating to some extent?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the TPP is dead now, at least in terms of U.S. involvement. And the question is what that means. And I think Jim is right. Modern trade agreements are much more about negotiating rules than they are about lowering tariffs. I mean, tariffs still matter, but they matter a lot less than they used to. President-elect Trump appears to have a very old-fashioned notion of trade, that things are made in one place and they're sold in another place. Well, we know for almost every major manufacturing good we consume, you know, a smartphone or computer or an airplane or an automobile, we now have global supply chains. Things are made everywhere. There are components from all over the world. They are assembled in some location.
Why do we have global supply chains? Why did that arise? Why do corporations sort of produce across countries as opposed to in a country?
I mean, if you think about trade theory, it actually makes a lot of sense, right? The fundamental underlying idea behind trade is that goods get produced in places that have a comparative advantage, where it's relatively inexpensive, you've got a good labor force, you've got conditions that allow you to produce that product. And then when you specialize, you can produce in bulk. And so it makes sense to produce, you know, the mufflers for a car in one place or the electronics for a car in another place and then assemble them in a third place.
It's an instance of a division of labor.
It's division of labor, and it's efficient.
When we talk about an iconic American product, right? The iPhone. Okay.
Yeah.
Same thing.
It's classic. I mean, there's 30 countries plus involved in the manufacturing of iPhones. And the result is, as consumers, we have much better products at much lower prices than we would have otherwise. So the way to think about TPP is TPP was really about trying to improve the efficiency and the governance of the supply chain, right? So it's not just to make it easy for corporations to move stuff around. If we're importing, for instance, mixtures for drugs or pharmaceuticals that we're going to consume, you know, that we're going to put in our bodies, we want to know that the regulations for those products in other countries are up to American standards. TPP helps with that. If we're going to have data flows across border, people are going to use the internet, we want rules governing that. So if we're going to import products from lower wage countries, this has been a U.S. issue for a long time. We want their labor standards to be strong. We want their environmental standards to be strong. Those were all the issues in TPP. It wasn't the old-fashioned, we make stuff and sell it to you and you make stuff and sell it to us. That's not the way it works anymore.
The other big aspect you touched on earlier, Ted, is the binding together of countries involved in trade deals. And the TPP was a big part of the vaunted rebalance or pivot to Asia. I think one of the first meetings that President-elect Trump is going to have with foreign leaders, with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, who's coming to New York to meet him, TPP seems like it's going to be on the agenda, although it seems to be also dead in the water. Can you talk, though, a little bit about what TPP or the killing of TPP means to that pivot, but also to a U.S. presence more broadly, the broader meaning of a U.S. presence in India?
Well, it will be very interesting to see how President Trump reacts to this, because, of course, President Obama was a critic of NAFTA during the 2008 campaign.
He was going to renegotiate NAFTA.
He was going to renegotiate NAFTA, right? And after he came into office, I think he realized, as presidents do, how important trade is as part of the U.S. foreign policy toolkit, that it helps to strengthen relationships with countries that matter to us in terms of military and security alliances. It's not something that presidents necessarily want to be left without, because it helps them build stronger ties with other countries in the world. Jim, you know, I'd be interested in your sense of, you know, the pivot to Asia. TPP was a big part of that, and without that, it's going to be harder to see how a President Trump signals the U.S. commitment to Asia in the face of a rising China.
Well, I think what we're seeing is Mr. Trump's, President-elect Trump's opposition to TPP is being read in Asia, as a lack of U.S. commitment to the region. And I think most people in Asia, East Asia, Southeast Asia, don't want an American commitment that is solely military. They want an economic commitment. And indeed, part of the argument for TPP was by setting these rules that would govern about 40% of the global economy, that this would, in fact, create rules that others would have to follow, particularly the Chinese. Because again, part of what you worry with the Chinese is while they have moved toward a market economy, they are not necessarily a market economy. A lot of state-owned enterprise.
And we should be clear, they were invited. It was signaled to them they could be part of the TPP down the road.
Well, and I think part of the idea behind TPP is that you would sort of set these rules and that you could bring more people into the so-called club. You kill it. The question is, okay, what else are you going to do? And this gets us back to the question we've discussed before, Ted, which is Mr. Trump has said that he doesn't like trade deals the United States has negotiated. He is going to deliver great trade deals. But has he actually told us what a great trade deal would look like? What would be in it so we could all say, yes, we've gotten that deal?
Yeah, I think that's very important because I don't want to leave the impression that the only significance of the Trump election is we're not going to move forward with the TPP or you know, the march of trade liberalization has been stalled. There is a real threat that we're going to move backwards in some significant ways. So in the campaign, Donald Trump said that he is going to be a tough negotiator who is going to use the threat of retaliation meaning raising tariffs on imported products from Mexico or from China or from other places, in order to force those countries to renegotiate their trade arrangements with the United States. We do not know yet, because he has not told us what he wants in that renegotiation. I mean, we know that he doesn't like the fact that Carrier is going to move its air conditioning factory to Mexico. He doesn't like the fact that Ford is going to move final assembly of some of its small cars to Mexico. But he has not, nor have any of his advisors, spelled out what changes he actually wants to see to the NAFTA with Mexico and Canada.
I mean, and it's important to point out that it is useful and common in negotiations of all kinds to make threats, to say, I'm going to walk away from the table as a way of trying to get more from the other side. But you have to, for that strategy to work, you have to know what it is that you want. And you have to be convinced that what you're going to get is going to outweigh in benefits what you might lose.
Yeah, you do. But it's important in the world of trade to realize that the United States voluntarily gave away most of its ability to make those threats when it joined the World Trade Organization in 1994. I mean, Trump talks a lot about Reagan. Reagan threatened and, in fact, imposed sanctions on the Japanese. Reagan had a clear goal. He wanted Japan to start buying more American cars and more American semiconductors. But in the 1980s, the U.S. president clearly, under international trade rules, had the power to do that. President Trump, if he chooses to abide by international trade rules, does not have that power. His only recourse is to complain to the World Trade Organization, allow the World Trade Organization's dispute settlement procedure to resolve the issue. That can take 2 years. And then if the United States wins, then he can impose tariffs. But I think it's unlikely that he's going to respect that process, even though the U.S. is committed to it.
But why couldn't the president, in essence, take a step and then, in essence, say to other countries, if you think I'm wrong, take me to the WTO and use that fact that it's going to take 2 years, maybe 3 years, for this to go through a fairly lengthy process of arbitration and dispute settlement mechanism. Why not do that and just sort of play the rules the other way? There's no requirement, is there, that the president has to sort of scrupulously stay on the side of what a standard trade lawyer would say is okay?
Yeah, but you know, as you know, in diplomacy as well as in domestic law, there's the letter of the law and there's the spirit of it. And the United States, since it joined the WTO, has tried quite scrupulously, often with some difficult political consequences for administrations, to abide by the spirit as well as the letter of the law. So going down the road of saying we're going to impose tariffs, even though we know it violates WTO rules, and China, go ahead, challenge us in the WTO. That is not the way the United States has behaved in the past.
But
that
it's would the be way a lot of other countries have played, isn't it?
Yeah, other countries certainly skirt closer. I mean, the Chinese have done things that I think you could call blatant violations of the rules. I think more often they try to make it look like it's within the rules, even though it's not. You could imagine a Trump administration kind of trying to play very close to the line the way the Chinese do. But there is a danger to this, right? There's a danger that if you play close to the line, then other countries are going to do the same. And I don't like when the media uses the term trade war. I think it's way overused. Trade war to me means escalating, tit for tat, imposition of tariffs on imports of the sort that we last saw in the 1930s. But when the United States, if the United States starts playing that way, I think the threat of a trade war then becomes real, that other countries do this kind of thing in response.
But then doesn't it depend upon how committed other countries are to existing rules? I mean, this is a theory of brinksmanship. Yeah. I'm going to do something that you don't think I would want to do, and you're so frightened I'm actually carried through on it that I'm going to go the extra mile to make sure the system doesn't fall apart. That's a possible way you could play this negotiation, right?
That is a possible way. But this again, we're talking about how different this is from the history of the last 70 years. The United States has seen itself as the protector of the system, as the country that wants to make sure that the rules are respected and that all countries play along. We're talking about a scenario in which the United States is going to disrespect the system openly and count on other countries having such a strong stake in it that they won't retaliate, that they'll play by the rules even when the United States is not playing by the rules. That is a different world.
And candidate Trump has indicated he might even buck the system or lead the system. One of his interviews, he was confronted with the fact that some or other protectionist measure that he was supporting would violate WTO rules. He said, well, I might look into leaving the WTO. All bets are off maybe with President Trump.
Right. I think quite possibly. I mean, if the United States loses a big case in the WTO, is a President Trump going to say, I respect the authority of the World Trade Organization in this issue? That's certainly not what a lot of people who voted for him expect him to do.
Right. But I think it's always important to mind people can go to the edge, and that may be the best way to extract concessions, but there's always a risk when you dance on the edge that you can fall off.
I think that's an excellent way of putting it, Jim.
So let me sort of play this out. We're going to have what appears to be a much more nationalistic or muscular trade policy in a Trump administration. At least, again, general caveat here, until we know who the president's team is, until he tells us what we're going to do, we're not really sure. But I think given how much Donald Trump stressed trade during the campaign, it's going to be a big part of his administration. So if we were to be more muscular, if we were to even just threaten tariff increases on other countries, how might that play out? Is it a threat that the United States can exercise and not worry about retaliation? Or is retaliation something you have to worry about, and who would feel the consequences?
Well, I mean, this will be interesting. I think one of the checks on a President Trump, if he goes down that road, is going to be the potential damage it causes here in the United States. So he would have to signal in some way that he's prepared to, you know, say, raise tariffs to 35% on some imported Mexican component. Well, you're going to have the U.S. companies that depend on that are going to complain. You have the states where there are investments that are dependent on trade with Mexico, they're going to complain. You're going to have the interests that might be harmed by a retaliation. I mean, take U.S. agriculture, for instance, you know, the American heartland. If we go after the Chinese, you know, they could stop buying American soybeans or American corn.
And I think it's important to point out that the Chinese, and they're obviously the biggest consumer out there, have a greater ability to decide what they're going to buy or not buy than the United States does, because they have so many state-owned companies. Whereas the United States, the president cannot tell Apple or GM or Caterpillar where to buy its products.
Yeah, I mean, aircraft is a great example here. Boeing is still the largest export in the United States. The Chinese have sort of quietly signaled, look, you come after us and we're not going to buy Boeing anymore. I mean, we're going to buy Airbus.
All of a sudden, Airbus looks like a better plane.
Airbus looks like a better plane. So I think that is something of a constraint on a President Trump, because there are going to be a lot of people and powerful interests in the United States who would be adversely affected by these sorts of actions, a lot of them in states with Republican governors. So there's going to be pushback.
I think this is an important point that it often gets lost in the trade discussion, because we focus on how trade costs the United States, how it costs jobs, and how it's hurt communities. But there are a lot of places around the United States that have benefited from trade. You know, you can argue about the exact measure, but 1 in 10, 1 in 5 U.S. jobs depend upon being able to sell American products abroad or on imports themselves. So we're tied into the global economy in the way we didn't used to be. And there are a lot of people whose livelihood depends upon an open international economy. And if that contracts, they're likely to speak up and say, hey, what about us?
That's actually a really good point. I think we can imagine a dramatic change in the public conversation, because a conversation on trade, as liberalization was moving forward, was from people saying, hey, we're getting hurt here. And there are some people who get hurt by trade for all of the benefits it brings. They're saying, hey, we're getting hurt and nobody's listening to us. And Donald Trump went out and said, I'm listening to you. I know you're getting hurt. But if we flip the other way and we begin to close our doors to the world, you're going to have people in all of the U.S. factories that are exporting, the farmers who are exporting, the companies that depend on imported components, consumers who watch the price of goods go up are suddenly going to raise their hand and say, hey, this is hurting us.
Well, that's an important thing to keep in mind. If you're an American manufacturer and we slap tariffs on a country that sends a lot of something, what that means is that your prices of building these is going to go up. Classic case 2001, we talked about this before, Ted. Bush administration slapped tariffs on Chinese steel. And it turned out there were a lot of American companies that got hurt by that action because they were benefiting from having low-cost Chinese steel to build buildings or to build their automobiles and what have you. Their price went up. The other risk in all this is that when you slap a tariff, let's say hypothetically on the Chinese, there's no guarantee that the net result of that is that people are going to switch and buy American products. You may end up just sort of shifting demand from buying Chinese products to Brazilian products or Vietnamese products. As we talk about all the things that might happen, and again, we should emphasize no one knows right now what a President Trump's trade policy will actually look like. Notwithstanding how much he talked in the campaign. But I'm wondering, sort of net it all out, Ted, what is the positive case for what Mr. Trump is proposing to do? What good could potentially come of it?
I mean, I think potentially if he carries it out with some care, the good could be a stronger focus on U.S. manufacturing. And there are a lot of people who sort of said, well, manufacturing is the industry of the past where services have come. I don't think that's true. Manufacturing is the most productive sector of any economy. It's where a lot of innovation occurs. And I think manufacturing in the United States has unfortunately been neglected in a lot of cases. I don't think we've set up trade policy, but not just trade. You know, policies in terms of supporting research and development, in terms of creating and building a skilled workforce, in terms of our patenting laws in different ways. We haven't really encouraged the expansion of manufacturing in the United States.
And a lot of other countries do.
A lot of other countries do. The Germans do this. The Japanese do this. Much higher percentages of their population work in manufacturing. I mean, we're not talking about millions of jobs here, but we are talking about a not insignificant number of good-paying jobs in highly productive industries that are critical for the future. So focus on manufacturing, I think, would be a good thing for the United States. It's been neglected too much.
And it's not the result in these countries. Germany, classic example, because the market's left to do what the market wants to do. It's because you have heavy government intervention that tries to set up incentives to encourage companies to do these sort of things. And again, that potentially puts Mr. Trump, if he were to go down that route, at odds with many Republicans.
It might not be heavy government intervention, but any time you start going down this road, it smacks of industrial policy, that the government is trying to think about, you know, which are the industries of the future, where should we be trying to nurture them. Republicans going all the way back to Ronald Reagan have just said, no, that's not the business of government, let the market decide. Well, the markets decided, but it decided in ways that left the Trump voters very unhappy. So a little more kind of sensible government intervention, I think, could be a positive outcome of this. But as you say, that would be a battle within the Republican Party.
But what about human capital? What about investing in apprenticeships, community college, getting a workforce that's better suited to the opportunities we have? We've noted since the Great Recession the oddity that many Americans are out of work and many American companies complaining they can't find the people they need with the right skills to do their business.
Yeah, these would all be good steps. I mean, President Trump has talked about big investments in infrastructure. I hope he will include in that human infrastructure, the skills of our population, which are the most critical component. So we will see. I haven't heard enough from him or his advisors, such as we know who they are, to suggest that this is going to be his approach. But potentially, I think that could be a positive outcome.
And these are, and to harken back to your book, Ted, these are things that other major industrial democracies have done with some success. So there is a template of some sort.
There are models, no question.
Right. And it's also a possibility for Mr. Trump's critics and his opponents, if you're looking for potential areas of compromise, to try to forge something along that line.
I agree. I do think that's an area where we could see a positive outcome. I can't say I'm optimistic, but I certainly think it's possible.
I wasn't saying you should bet on it, but I'm just trying to think of sort of ways where you might be able to find an outcome where everyone feels they've gotten something that serves their vision of how to make America stronger and better.
Well, that sounds like a positive note, so I'll stick with it.
And we'll end on that note. Thanks for joining us for The President's Inbox. Ted, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thanks, Bob. Thank you, Jim.
Tune in next week for another priority that President-elect Trump must face, immigration policy. Ted Alden will be back with us to talk about that.
Be sure to subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests. not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineer John Fletcher, with special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay.
This is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.